Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Grace Gotchling. In the consolidated cases, Trump v. Mazars, USA, and Trump v. Deutsche Bank, at issue is whether the Committee on Oversight and Reform of the U.S. House of Representatives has the constitutional and statutory authority to issue a subpoena to the accountant for President Trump and several of his business entities demanding private financial records belonging to the president. These cases are linked with Trump v. Vance, a case asking whether a grand jury subpoena served on a custodian of the president's personal records, demanding production of nearly 10 years' worth of the president's financial papers and his tax returns, violates Article II and the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. And now, to discuss the case, we have Devin Watkins, attorney at the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
I'm glad to be here. So in talking about the oral arguments, I want to start with one thing. I'm not a mind reader. I don't know how the justices will decide the case. That said, the questions of the justices sometimes provide clues as how they're likely to vote or what direction they tend to be heading. Sometimes we think they're going one way and they end up going another way. So nothing we say that was said today, they could have been acting, for instance, as devil's advocate arguing something that they even themselves don't believe. So we don't know for certain how the court is going to go till we see the final decision. The cases today dealt with the financial records of President Trump. Most importantly, his tax returns, but there were a lot of other financial records related to his businesses and a variety of other financial records other than just the tax returns, although that was obviously a very critical element. I'm going to start with the cases that were first on the docket, which is the congressional subpoenas. These are subpoenas that were issued by three committees of the House of Representatives against President Trump for his financial records. As you may know, a variety of previous presidents had distributed their tax returns, but President Trump had not. And there were a variety of people in the House of Representatives that wanted access to those, and they subpoenaed them. And the key question that comes before the court is there a legitimate legislative purpose for this? The House of Representatives, in the text of the Constitution, doesn't actually say anywhere that they have the power to subpoena anything. And so that power has been implied from the other powers of Congress. But to be able to do that, there has to be some type of legitimate legislative purpose. So the right wing of the court tended to focus primarily on these balance of power issues at stake. What is the source of this congressional subpoena power? What are its limits? Especially because it doesn't appear directly in the text of the Constitution. These limits also must be implied if this power exists. The left wing of the court didn't focus as much on the direct questions like that, but more on the history, because there's a lot of history of subpoenas by various House committees, and it's very, very broad. They focused on the Paula Jones case, the Whitewater case, and the subpoenas that were issued for various Hillary Clinton private records. And in these cases, they weren't actually challenged. So a lot of times the Congress would submit the subpoena to the president or someone else, and then they would enter into negotiations on exactly how much to give. The president says, we're not going to give you everything you want, but we'll give you something. And Congress says, okay, that's good enough. And they're given the records. So the question first is, how much does this historical precedent actually provide some type of precedent as to the constitutional powers and limits of Congress? If everything that was provided voluntarily was something that Congress could have subpoenaed and got it anyway, or was it something that perhaps Congress couldn't have done, but the president decided to give it to them anyway? It's very tricky there. And the left-wing of the court was very focused on the history of all of the subpoenas and the records being provided, even of the president or people high up in the administration. The next question dealt with personal records or official records. So there's a lot, everyone acknowledges that the Congress has to understand the operations of government to be able to legislate properly. And so that has one standard. It's done quite often where the subpoenas are issued. But for personal records like this, the question is, what is that standard? Is it the same as the official standard? Is it higher or is it lower? The left wing of the court suggested that there should be a lower standard than for official records, because official records implicate the core operations of very important functions of government, and these personal records don't have those implications. And the next question had to do with the what was sometimes referred to as the Nixon standard, a heightened inquiry. There was a lot of the court had gone and considered the subpoena to Nixon. And so obviously a subpoena issued to the president was going to be very important to deciding these subpoenas that were issued to the president. There was a lot of differences, though, between the Nixon standard and these standards. One of the most important differences is that Nixon had raised a claim of executive privilege. This is the privilege that extends between the president and his closest advisors about closely held discussions on what the president should do. And where those advisors are advising the president, there's a very important protection there that those be kept somewhat secret so that the people advising the president feel free to give their candid advice rather than advice that they may not want to give if it were publicly revealed later. And in the case of Nixon, the court had held that there's a heightened inquiry into, is this really needed? Is there some other way to get these records? You know, there has to be something more than just the normal subpoena amount. And the question is that because it was the president being submitted the subpoena, or is it because he had raised the idea that this was protected by executive privilege? The left wing of the court emphasized the executive privilege claim very strongly. And I've been focusing primarily on the questioning of the government's counsel. They were the first ones to come up. But then the committee's lawyer came up to try to defend these subpoenas. And probably the biggest question, the most important question in my mind that was submitted to the committee's attorney was by the Chief Justice. This was whether he can give any example of a subpoena that would be invalid because there was no legitimate legislative purpose. The Chief Justice was basically asking for a limiting principle. How far can you go and no further? And the committee's lawyer could not come up with a single example, could not say any kind of subpoena that wouldn't potentially lead to legislation and therefore be a legitimate legislative purpose. And this becomes much, much worse as you go on and you see a lot of the other justices continue to reiterate this point, because if the only limitation on the subpoena power was this legitimate legislative purpose and any subpoena would meet that standard, it really wasn't a limitation at all. So that was probably the biggest point. I got to say, personally, I came into this rather split. I didn't know which side would win. There's a lot of history, the left wing of the court was pointing to it, where a lot of previous subpoenas by Congress was issued to the president or other people, and the court gave very broad latitude to congressional subpoenas on the legitimate legislative purpose was very broad, and it was hard to see anything that would be limited to it. But when you actually see the government, committee's attorney come up and say that basically any subpoena could be valid if the committee wanted to investigate that. It seemed like there was a lot of pushback to that idea, even by some of the left wing of the court, which suggested that may be going too far. Thomas, of course, suggested that the subpoena power might not exist at all. It isn't mentioned anywhere in the Constitution, so why does the committees have any power at all. I wouldn't be surprised to see either dissent or concurrence by Thomas that suggests that there isn't such a power. He probably isn't going to have anyone else. He might get Gorsuch to join him, but probably no one else. But at the moment, it looked like all of the right wing of the court seemed to be supporting the president, and left wing of the court is probably opposed to the president on this issue. And so I'm suspecting that it'll probably be 5-4 in that way. But it's hard to know. One of the justices could change their mind, or, you know, could be reading a little bit too much into their questions. So now I'd like to go on to the second case here, Trump v. Vance. Both of these cases concern the financial records of the president, including his tax returns. But Trump v. Vance dealt with a local grand jury subpoena rather than a congressional subpoena. It doesn't have the legitimate legislative purpose requirement behind it, but instead has another requirement that it has to be kind of relevant to these potential criminal investigations of various misconduct. So the president's attorney, a personal attorney, there was actually two different attorneys, one representing the president personally, and then there was another attorney representing the United States by the Department of Justice. So the president's personal attorney put forward the argument that the president cannot be investigated at all for any criminal behavior by any state or local attorney while he's in office. This was quite a stretch. So I got to say, I listened to the arguments before when they were at the lower court, and I did not see them as very likely to have a lot of weight going forward. But they brought them up again before the court, but I didn't see almost any of the justices that seemed to go along with that. Even Justice Thomas, which was the next to ask questions, asked, where does this immunity come from in the Constitution? It isn't listed anywhere in the Constitution. What historical precedent for this immunity exists? The attorney for the president talked about some letters being discussed among the founders about how there could be hostile process against the president. But to me, it seemed very weak on the arguments that were given. Now, the DOJ argument was a lot more refined. They didn't argue the kind of blanket immunity that Trump's personal attorney argued. They instead argued for a special needs standard as to why the local or state prosecutor needed the information. They had to show something more than, yeah, maybe there might be a crime in there. Let's go dig through the financial records and see if we can find something. They got to do more than a fishing exercise. They got to meet, you know, is there another way that they could get this information without subpoenaing the private records of the president? Is there some reason that they have to have it now rather than later after the president is out of office? The interesting thing is that the New York attorney, he had a standard that was mostly similar to the DOJ standard, but he flipped the order. So rather than the DOJ standard, which basically says to the attorney, you're requesting this information, okay, give us why you need this information, let the court consider that, and then we'll move on to the other privileges and other claims are. The New York attorney says, we submit the subpoena, and then it's the president's responsibility to come and say why that subpoena should be quashed. What is the Second Amendment interest that's potentially harmed here? And then the court needs to kind of balance that Article 2 interest. The Article 2 interest that's potentially harmed. And then the court can balance the interest in Article 2 against the interest of the local or state attorney to try to get the information so that they can bring a potential case. And one of the other interesting or important aspects to this isn't necessarily the prosecution of the president, either after he's out of office or whenever, but the prosecution of other people that are closely associated with the president. For instance, imagine the president is talking with someone else on the phone or via email, and this local or state attorney wants to prosecute not the president, but that other person. can the attorney go and get that email without going through all this rigmarole and heightened standard and stuff like that? Do they have to go to federal court to ask permission to get these just because they were talking with the president rather than the target of the investigation? I definitely see a lot of similarities, and I saw among the justices' questions, and Justice Gorsuch had asked what the differences are. He didn't see almost any differences between the DOJ position and the New York position. So I suspect that the justices are probably going to pick something that's kind of an amalgam of the DOJ position and the New York position, maybe a little bit more towards one side or more towards the other side, where it won't be kind of a blanket, absolute, no immunity, absolute immunity to any investigation of the president, but more some type of special standard, some type of heightened standard when they're going to seek the records of the president. Maybe they'll require the president to say why there's some harm to an Article II interest first. They will probably say that there's going to be something more than just a fishing exercise into the president's records. That said, both DOJ and New York agree that this should be decided in federal court, not state court. That's important because state courts and are going to be more amenable to the local interests of that state and not the more federal interests of the entire United States. So the key problems from the New York point of view is the statute of limitations. As the president's attorneys argue, if there's an absolute blanket immunity to any investigation at all, the statute of limitations might run before the president gets out of office and they can investigate these things. That would lead to them never being prosecuted at all for the crime. And that doesn't make any sense at all. There has to be some way that the statute of limitations is either told, which there's not currently in law and statutes or in the Supreme Court's precedent, but perhaps they might add some type of tolling provision to the statute of limitations. I'm not sure about that yet. But if there that was suggested by several of the justices' questions, but we don't know yet if they're going to actually think about adding that or not. But even if there is or isn't a statute of limitations problem, it seems likely that the court is going to say that there can be investigations of the president or people closely associated with the president at the local level with the protections that the grand jury provisions apply. So that means that there would be protections that would prevent this information, even though it was given to the grand jury and the local prosecutor, from them being distributed to the public.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.